Osiris.
I'm your host, Jonathan Schenk. We're going to be exploring the evolution of jam through the lens of key genres, events, and moments. Its connection to the mainstream, as told by artists, several of my friends, industry icons, and tastemakers. Hopefully, we're going to be enjoying a slice of toast and jam as well somewhere along the way, but we'll see. Each episode is going to feature a special guest, and today I'm very excited to welcome a friend of mine. Before we get there, I think it's really important just to talk about the main components of jam and kind of how we got here. And I really think about a few different boxes to check. One of those is, of course, improvisation, collaboration, building a core audience, which I think is really one of the main elements that sets a jam band apart. And also, many of our favorite artists like to indulge in cover music as well and celebrate some of their other favorite artists. Along with me today, I'm going to introduce a scholar of the jam band scene, a filmmaker, an author, and also someone who is the editor-in-chief of Relics, created jambands.com, and the Jammy Awards. We've had the pleasure of connecting on many different occasions over the past two decades, and it's an honor to have him here with me today. And I have to say, he's always supported all of my projects, so I'm eternally grateful for that. Please welcome my friend, Dean Budnick.
How could I not support your projects? Good stuff, man. I mean, come on now. That's no credit to me whatsoever. That's full credit to you and what you've had going on over the years.
I just wanted to give you, you know, the proper intro, because I do feel like the one thing I didn't say in that intro, and I've said this several times, is to me, you are really the foremost scholar of jam music, and you know, beyond you know, what you've experienced personally, you know, I really see you as a musicologist and somebody who understands all of the tentacles of where this all emanated from and where this came from and how we got to this point, because there's been many ebbs and flows in our scene, right? And there have been several iconic people along the way that have helped lift it up or helped, you know, poke pop culture in the meantime. And I think you've done an amazing job of, you know, just carrying on the legacy of a lot of these artists, but also at the same time, lifting up new artists, you know, when they came along. And I feel like as kind of the core audience of the jam scene, we're always looking for things to lift up, right? And I think that it's really amazing to watch kind of this new golden era of our scene that we've now entered into.
That's fair. Listen, I aspire to be inspired by music. And when that happens, sure as heck, I'm going to share it. That's why I'm here. That's the glory of the gig. It's the opportunity to do that. Just similar to what you do, you know, from your own perspective as well. I mean, that's the beauty of it all, that we, you know what came before. We have a sense of where maybe we might be going, but it's all about being in the moment, being in the now, and connecting with whatever it might be, whatever you might see and or hear, hopefully both, one or the other's okay, and see where that takes you. So the idea that I can go out and find something new, hear something new, is, you know, it adds zest, it adds, you know, it makes things more interesting, delightful, you know, and the like.
So let's talk about that connectivity for a second, because ultimately that connective tissue is what we really want to explore. And let's go back to 1991 when Perry Farrell assembled a traveling circus that nobody knew what was going to become of it. But now of course, one of the most iconic festival brands, Lollapalooza, was born in 1991. And you had Nine Inch Nails, Susie and the Banshees, you know, Jane's Addiction, and several other incredible artists that were on that tour. And it really brought together a new touring model at that time and gave birth to the Horde Tour in 1992 with Blues Traveler. I mean, how do you think that evolution serves us today in terms of where we are today as a scene?
Sure. Well, let me just say I have some insight into it because I co-wrote John Popper's book with him and spent many, many hours talking to him about this very topic, above and beyond the fact that I was there in Cumberland County, Maine in July of 1992 for that very first Horde show, which was extraordinary. Parenthetically, maybe we can come back to in a moment what it felt like to be in there and experience that and see all the other fans. That was really the kicker for me. But I do think that, you know, Popper was aware of Lollapalooza. By the way, for me, also Butthole Surfers were on stage with like shotguns shooting out over the crowd. That's my memory of seeing Lollapalooza in the summer of 91 at Greatwoods. In Mansfield, Mass.
And the other thing that was really cool about Horde that I remember is when the artwork first came out, and you know, at that time, we, of course, got to see all of our artwork in print, all of the ad mats in print. And I just remember opening up the newspaper and seeing the Horde artwork and being like, that looks really cool, and what a great collection of artists. And really feels like that was the first time that there was a really kind of traveling festival, so to speak, of, you know, improvisational bands.
Listen, I think there's no question, and there's not just a singular legacy. There are plenty of legacies that came out of that, whether it's, you know, Phish hosting a festival, which, by the way, led to Bonnaroo in 2002. You saw a particle there, by the way. But there are a lot of different things. There are a lot of different components to it. And what I love about Horde is the initial moment when it came together was John Popper, right, and Blues Traveler. Their manager was Dave Graham, Bill Graham. They're working out at Bill Graham's offices in New York. And they invite in some fellow like-minded musicians who they met, frankly, initially at Wetlands in New York. And the rule is no managers, just the artists. And so, you know, you have people from Widespread Panic and Spin Docs and all of Phish who were there and, you know, Colonel Bruce. And that's how that came together. They have that discussion about what are they going to do? Is there a way they can pool their resources to play amphitheaters and, you know, throughout the country? And that was their initial goal when amphitheaters, not that amphitheaters aren't important now, but a little bit earlier when it was all the more special, I think, for people to get out and play in that sort of context. And so they got everyone came together and they said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're all going to play for the same amount of time. We're all going to make the same amount of money. We're all going to be on stage for the same amount. And the musicians
and collaborate,
right? And the musicians walked out of there.
Yeah.
And then they told their managers what they wanted to do. And their manager said, you're crazy because so-and-so is worth so-and-so in this amount in a market.
Yep.
And you can't possibly do that. And who is ARU? Why is ARU on this?
Why is one plus one 3 or 10 in this, you know? And I have to give credit to Popper and Blues Traveler a bit on this because I actually think that a lot of the sales at that moment were driven by FM radio. By every day, you know, by, you know, but anyway, 100 years, the activity that Blues Traveler is getting, you know, again, back to piercing the mainstream, there was a little bit of FM rock radio audience that was, you know, driving to those shows because of the success that Blues Traveler was having. And there was other tours at that time that I think didn't have core audiences. I remember going to the Spin Doctors Screaming Trees Soul Asylum tour. And you know, that was the summer of 93. And that was essentially grown out of Horde and trying to figure out additional mainstream ways to get these groups of bands out there. Those bands, of course, didn't survive in the same way because they didn't have core audiences underneath them the same way that Traveler, Fish, and Panic ultimately did. And, you know, I think that tour actually was the MTV Alternative Nation tour. And in some ways, that might have been, you know, the left turn that they took that took them away from this, you know, core audience and improvisational scene. And to me, coming right off the backside of that, you have Fish being ready to headline amphitheaters in the Northeast in 1993, The Man, et cetera. And I certainly remember being in the parking lot for The Man in 93.
Was it right? It's an interesting moment. I saw the show, that Spin Docs, that package. I saw it at in an amusement park in Western Massachusetts.
Great
and
show.
It was okay, but it felt a little staccato.
Yeah.
It didn't feel, you know, and nobody, there were no sit-ins. It was its own thing.
Yeah.
You know, but somewhat to this end though, the other thing is that, so Pocket Full of Kryptonite, Spin Doctors, right? That came out in 91 and starts to really gain traction in 92. And there were some questions as to whether they should, you know, play a little bit later on Horde, maybe get a little bit more money than initially on Horde. But ultimately, because they were such close friends the first time around on those eight shows, they worked it out. But then, you know, this is before, of course, Blues Traveler's 4 album, which is 1994.
Yeah.
So really, Spin Doctors were the one band that was getting some kind of airplay. And the other thing I would say about that is I saw Spin Doctors at Wetlands. I was living in New York at that time, right after Wetlands opened, Wetlands Preserve opens in 1989. I mean, if you know, people want to check it out, it's actually, you can see it online, called Wetlands Preserve, the story of an activist rock club, an amazing place. But seeing Spin Doctors then and there, they were so much more open-ended in what they were doing.
Yeah.
And it was this big old improvisational funk band in many respects. And I don't begrudge them anything. I think part of it was they were still building their repertoire, you know, writing new songs along the way. But the Spin Doctors you would see in 93 were not the Spin Doctors that I had first seen in 1990. It's just the evolution of the band. Similarly, a different band, a different time, but Dave Matthews Band, I saw Wetlands. And they did the same thing. It was much more open-ended.
So
because
open.
They all came out of jazz backgrounds, right? Except for Dave, even though he loved it. And part of it in talking to him subsequently was just that they didn't have a lot of songs and they had a skill in improvisation. So that's what they did. I mean, you listen back, there's so many amazing things that are happening on stage then and there. Not that there aren't now, but it's a very different band. And he would say, you know, I think he probably likes the current band. They've come to this point. And, you know, maybe he thought some of that stuff was self-indulgent, but it was really, really, really interesting. But it was because they simply didn't have enough songs in the repertoire.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, there are so many different factors and considerations that inform all of these little things that people might not think about. But I would say, in going back to Horde, that I really think Wetlands has to get its due, at least for connecting a lot of these groups. I saw, you know, Traveler and Spin Doctors play there so many times. I saw Traveler and Widespread Panic, and then they would swap gigs. You know, I saw Fish there, and then Fish would swap gigs with Panic down south. I mean, there were a lot of things that happened as a result of that one club in New York, an important media town, an owner, Larry Block, who founded the club before Peter Shapiro took over and took it to new heights and did wonderful things. But Larry Block was a deadhead and not a club owner, who would do very strange things like give bands advice on what their set list should be, which is crazy, right? And no one does that. And he would say, you have to play two sets and that the second set has to go be after midnight. And I'm going to come in. Larry would be the DJ. He was going to DJ Grateful Dead music in between the sets because that's what was important to him. That's what he was passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, there was the Eco Center, which and an environmental group, a non-profit environmental group that was out there initiating direct action in all of that. And Larry would have, you know, free Dead Center nights on Wednesday nights. People could see these Grateful Dead cover bands for free, but it would be just after the meetings for the Activist Center with the hope that people would come in. And I do think that sort of righteous approach to everything really had an impact on the community, on the bands, and where that all went. And one last point into all of this, and there's so many things, right, because it's all over the place, is you really have to keep in mind, relative to Wetlands, but still true of Horde in 92, there's no World Wide Web. You know, there are some people who were on Usenet news groups, like I was. There were some people who were on The Well, which tended to be, you know, West Coast Deadhead fans, and other people as well, other people in tech. But, you know, this is where you found out. This is where you connected with other people and learned about what was going on. And it was an amazing moment to be able to find other like-minded folks that you could talk to about these bands that were not getting mainstream airplay, but so many people were so passionate about them.
Absolutely. We were just, you know, hoping to get our box of tapes from Terrapin Tapes and, you know, find some good people to exchange with, right? Good people to be on the river with. I think that's what we're always hoping for. Tom Petty, actually, you know, I saw him speak before he passed away, and he gave like kind of a rare speech at this event. And something that really stuck with me during it was that at the very end, he talked about a birthday card that he got from Johnny Cash before he had passed away. And the card said, I just want to be somebody who's good to be on the river with, and it's good to be on the river with you. And I think that kind of, you know, encapsulates what you're saying. And I think that we're all on the river and, you know, kind of carrying that forward after, you know, Phish's amphitheater tour in 93, Hoist is brewing up, and you can't help but thinking that Trey is thinking about those 1,000 barefoot children outside dancing on his lawn, right? I mean, because maybe before that, they might have just been dancing in Wetlands. And so I think it's a really interesting point of, you know, that Horde really opened the doors, you know, if we're looking at it in a set list kind of format, that Wetlands really led to this collective of bands that, you know, birthed the Horde, and that ultimately paved the way for Phish to be able to have an annual outdoor amphitheater tour. And if you think about this in industry terminology, prior to 1997, all of the amphitheaters were owned and operated independently. It wasn't until 1997 that SFX came in under Robert Sillerman and started to consolidate the contemporary productions, the BGPs, the Delsner Slaters of the world, and to really try to figure out how to move these tours around in a more collective way. That, of course, now is what we now know as Live Nation. But in 1997, there was no collection of amphitheaters, so all of the artists had to go at it on their own to figure out which markets to kind of plug and play. And to me, the evolution of all of these festival touring attractions and collection of bands is what led to the success of the amphitheaters, and probably ultimately what led to the consolidation and growth of the owned and operated amphitheater model that we now know today.
Yeah, listen, it was all of those independent promoters who would build relationships with artists and build those relationships sometimes because there'd be competing promoters in the same city. And so they try to say, oh, I have history with this band and the like, which you see a little bit less of now. That sort of this sense of like history with an artist that a promoter might have has sort of fallen by the wayside. I'm not saying there aren't examples of it, but to my mind, it tends to be a lot more contractual than anything else. But back then you built relationships. I think of the Grateful Dead, right? When the Grateful Dead set up their own ticketing and wanted 50% of the tickets to any of the shows that they were performing at, so that they could sell through GDTS, right? Mm-hmm. Through their own ticketing service. And Ticketmaster, which had exclusive contracts with many of these facilities, said, no, how is that? You can't, they would say to the venues, you can't do that. We have an agreement with you. You signed an agreement, right? We've paid you your signing bonus. We've given you the advance against the fees. Aside from that, you signed on the bottom line, and you have to allow us to distribute 100% of the tickets to these shows. And what ultimately happens in that case is the Grateful Dead had relationships with the promoters. And so the promoters were willing to stand up for the good old Grateful Dead and say, no, Ticketmaster, you know, look at, we have this going on with the band. They've been doing it with us, for us, for quite some time. And as a result, Ticketmaster, they lost that battle. You know, there was my book, Ticketmasters, that came out with Josh Baron, has a whole chapter on Grateful Dead.
Shout out to Josh Baron.
Shout out to Josh Baron, former editor at Relics, who's now doing other great things in the world, actually in the world of ticketing in particular. But the Grateful Dead took that pretty far, and it came out of existing relationships between the artist and the promoter, which on some level have fallen by the wayside. So we did this tour in 99, and we went to the Theater of Living Arts, the TLA,
of course, in Philadelphia. Hometown. So
I was there.
The Slip Galactic.
That one was the Slip Viper House. Viper House. That was the hot band, right? They had it going on at that particular moment in time.
There was label interest there or something, I think.
Yes, and the recipe. So, well, here's what happened. The Slip is obviously the low band on the totem pole.
Shout out to Kartzman.
and the Barr Brothers, the Barrs. What the heck, and Mark Freeman too.
Yeah.
And they got lost in traffic. And so they missed the time that they were supposed to load in, but they showed up 15 minutes later, 20 minutes later, and the production manager says, "No Slip for you. No way. They're not on the bill tonight." They didn't show up and said, "We had Paul Simon in this room 2 weeks ago. And if Paul Simon could be there on time, this band can be there on time." And also on this tour with me, because he was scouting bands, was Butch Trux, the late great drummer for the Allman Brothers Band, and O'Teal Burbridge, Allman Brothers Band, Dead Co, O'Teal Burbridge fame. Anyhow, they were with me. They were scouting bands for Flying Frog Records. Mm-hmm. And Butch really wanted to see The Slip. And that was the band that he was, and eventually he would sign them, to the label.
Yep.
But The Slip was not going to play that night. And so Butch gets on the phone with Larry Maggott. Larry Maggott is like old school, one of the original promoters in the 1960s, early 70s, you know, that was anointed, that became part of that first generation of promoters who the great agent Frank Barcelona agreed, okay, you know, we're going to pick Don Law in this city, Jack Boyle in DC, and all. So there were certain promoters who had relationships. So Butch calls Larry Maggott at home and says, "Listen, my boys can't take the stage tonight," you know, and Larry Maggott is pissed because the production manager, who had basically told us, you know, in no uncertain terms, there is no way The Slip's getting on the stage tonight, comes back to us about 15 minutes later, says, "I don't even care. Whatever you want to do, I don't even care." And so not only did The Slip play, but you may remember Butch and O'Teal sat in with them because it was like such a glorious moment that I felt like, you know, the good folks won that one. They were 15 minutes late. There was no reason. There was still plenty. It was like 4 p.m.
Yeah.
There was no reason they couldn't have gone on stage. At any rate, I guess what I'm getting at is as you well know in this world, like, relationships matter. And I think they're definitely, and this is still true. You know, artists have special relationships with many promoters and other people in the industry. But I think early on, going back to Chord, in 92, or some of the Fish stuff, and Fish's great agent Chip Hooper, who the late great again, who had relationships with other people. There were so many individuals that we all felt like they were part of something and would help facilitate this. And I do think that's sort of the backstory in many respects as to how some of this came together and how some of these bands, you know, would be presented to larger and larger audiences who then tell their friends. I remember going to see Fish in 1992 with Symphony Hall. It was their New Year's Eve run. That's the, and I'm sitting there with a friend of mine. We had seen Fish for a few years. And I just said to him, because it was a really nice venue, I'm like, how big do you think Fish can be. You know, we're seeing them now. They're playing at this symphony hall. That's, you know, a couple thousand people. And my friend said to me, Manny, David Soslovsky, give him full credit. He said to me, we like them. Why wouldn't everyone else? And I always think about that when I think about how popular a band can be or what the ceiling might be for a group. Well, if I like them, if I think they're good, why wouldn't anyone else? And I understand tastes are different and they and the like, but still, I try to have faith that if something moves me, then there's a good shot, at least, that some other human beings out there will be similarly moved.
Everybody had fun lifting it up. Everybody wanted to be part of the lift. And I think that there is a certain amount of pride that everybody took in seeing it become more viral at the time, which wasn't even a word, more, you know, just kind of wherever they could pierce pop culture. And just, of course, we were so passionate about it. Why wouldn't everybody else follow suit? But I think at the same time, there was something else brewing there too, which is that the, you know, kind of late 90s, or, you know, the early 90s deadheads that became the, you know, late 90s fish fans, fish heads, so to speak, it bore a lot of folks that are now industry icons. And, you know, it, that's how the, you know, the ticketing business was redefined. That's how the VIP business was redefined. That's how, you know, I think a lot of these things happened because you had a lot of people that were deadheads that understood the marketing paradigm, that at least wanted to further dive into why or how this all ticked. And I think that there's so many names we can point to right now of people that are influential in the music industry that came from, you know, that scene at that time. Not just that scene, came from that scene at that time.
I think there's no question. I think that scene was just sort of finding itself in many respects. I mean, speaking of that, I'm just thinking of it now as you're talking about it, not even on the industry level, in which I think you can look, by the way, at a bunch of people who were working on their, you know, their college booking committees and brought in Fish. Yes. At various places. But I was just thinking about the fan community side, pure and simple. I remember being at the Beacon Theater in April of 94, when the audience, it's the first time I ever experienced it. I'm pretty sure it's the first time it ever happened. You know, during the song Wilson, that the audience contributes the Wilson chant back at the stage. I remember thinking, good gosh, look at what's happening here. And you could see it on the band members' faces. They did not expect that was coming at them, but it just demonstrated the sense that we're all part of something.
And that's, you know, that's really a great, I think, you know, kind of segue into our next piece, which is that every episode of The Jam is going to feature a special segment of music and one that we hope, you know, really reflects the ethos of this podcast. And back in 2002, Dean, along with Peter Shapiro, previous 2002, had created the Jammy Awards. But in 2002, I was lucky enough to collaborate with them. And I called Peter. At the time, I was working at a management company that managed the B-52s. And this kind of speaks to my plight of really trying to find ways to insert mainstream culture into the jam scene. And at the time, I had spoken to the members of the B-52s about collaborating with band I was managing at the time, Particle. And I remember calling Peter and telling him the idea. And he was always on board with pretty much anything I ever called him about. But this particular idea, he was over the moon about, because it sprinkled a little bit of pop music dust onto what was happening in largely a very organic scene. And so we're going to roll into a 13 and a half minute version of Love Shack with Fred Schneider and Kate Pearson of the B-52s with Particle. And after that, we'll be back to talk with Dean a little bit more. We'll be right back. we're back on the Jam. I mean, that electro-filled Love Shack just blows me away every time. I actually hadn't revisited that in quite a while and didn't have reference point that it was an over 13-minute version of that song. The story that I remember so clearly from that evening, actually, the story took place the day before. So there was a room rented for rehearsal at Studio Instrument Rentals, shorthand SIR. So we had our rehearsal with the B-52s and Particle in New York City the day before this event in 2002 at the Roseland Ballroom. And we're in this room, and during the sound check, Fred Schneider from the B-52s calls me to the stage. And I said, you know, how can I help you? And he said, well, I'm going to need a red tambourine. And I said, that's no problem. Absolutely. We'll make sure tomorrow that there is a red tambourine there for you. And he said, no, you don't understand, Jonathan. I need the red tambourine now. And I said, well, wait, we have other tambourines here now, but we don't have a red tambourine. And so, you know where this story goes. Next thing you know, I'm jogging down the street to find Manny's Music. Find any music store. Gosh, I don't even know if I knew what Manny's Music was at that time. So I'm trying to find this place, Manny's Music, which is down the street from SIR. And I remember going in there and I'm sweaty. And it's kind of like reminds me of that scene in that movie Best in Show where the dog owner loses the plushie and they're going in and they're like, that's not the bee. That's not the bee. You know, I need the bee. And of course, I found every color tambourine except red. And the rehearsal had to be delayed for an hour because he wanted a red tambourine. I did eventually find that red tambourine. And anyone who's listening can go onto YouTube and find that video and watch Fred Schneider play that red tambourine. Courtesy of Manny's Music. Shout out to Fred Schneider and Kate Pearson from the B-52s. Thank you for being such good sports and improvising with Particle and letting us bring you into our crazy little scene and just being a part of it. You guys were amazing. And looking back on that performance 22 years later, it stands up. And you guys did a really cool thing. You also performed Private Idaho. And that's one of my favorite B-52s songs. And just want to give a shout out because that's what the Jammies to me was all about. And I don't know, Dean, thank you so much for supporting that performance.
What I remember of the Particle set with Fred and Kate is because I was the MC, I had a camera and I would go down to there were two stages side by side, and I would go down. I was sort of monitoring the award stage, which was the original stage at Roseland. This was the beauty of the Jammies, by the way, is there were two stages at Roseland because there was the first one. And then they made a second one, which became the principal one because it was bigger.
Is that like but when no one had ever Deep used Banana Blackout was jamming or something like that?
Yeah, we had Derek Trucks Band 1 year. We had a Tom Tom Club. But yes. No one had ever used both stages as stages. The second stage was usually a VIP level.
We would stand there and watch shows.
Yeah. But I walked in and Peter and I were like, we can do something musically with this. Why don't we have this be the award stage? We'll put our house band there. And then if we're really, really lucky, the end of the night, we'll have everybody. Two bands. We'll go across the stage and we'll see what goes down. So what I would do during some of the bands on the main stage is I had my camera. I was shooting I still shoot to this day and I was back then. So I would go over down into the pit in front of the other stage and shoot because I knew I had a little bit of time. And what I remember of the Particle set was Fred and in particular Kate. During the improvisational sequences, they just kept dancing.
They were
and
going.
You could see they had it going on. It was great.
And that's 13 minutes of dancing.
Yeah.
In sparkly tight suits. So
the other thing, that 2002 Jammies, which was our third one, because you know you mentioned Trey being there with Warren. The way the show ended is it was going to be Bob Weir with Rat Dog. And then we were going to go across to the other stage and have some people perform on that second stage. And the production was a little bit tricky to make it work.
I remember.
And so there was about, I'm not proud of this, maybe a 45 minute to 60 minute lapse before Rat Dog set. after Bob Weir had accepted his Lifetime Achievement Award, but before the Rat Dog took the stage, and to my, just about nobody left. It was getting really, really late. Although one person who did leave, so this was a little bit earlier, was Al Franken, who was going to give the award to Bobby. And he's like, no, he's, I understand. This is the Jammies, you know, and I had invited him and pitched him really, really hard on it. And then I remember just chasing him out on 52nd Street. No, Al, you can't leave. You're going to give this thing to Bobby. And, it was fine. He was cool, whatever. But he had something to do the next day. But then when we finally had that Rat Dog set, it was just so climactic with all of the people.
The Mount Rushmore of Jam.
Yeah, I think they called it in the New York Times the next day, the Jam of the Titans. I'll never forget that.
I wasn't far off, okay? I actually have a black and white photo framed somewhere in my archive from that. And the photo is a very affectionate Warren leaning into Trey as they're both looking out. And Popper's kind of off to the side jamming. And it's one of these photos that kind of, you know, tells a story because you can look into their eyes and you can just feel that it's a special moment. And it's a collective of people that are lifting something up that's really, really amazing and unique and special. And I just want to say, Dean, I don't remember a 45-minute hiatus. All I remember is that you presented the Titans of Jam.
It was, well, you know, I ended up using, there's a picture that I took, and that one I couldn't get down to the pit. I was standing on the other stage. I'm looking at it now because it's on the back of my Jam Bands book from 2004, where I'm looking, it's like Al Schneer from Mo, it's Trey, it's Warren, it's Popper. It's Mark Caron, it's Bobby, it's Wasserman. Now remember too, though, we had Mike Gordon on our stage. Amazing. And they were jamming back and forth. Yeah. Like we realized our goal and it was just so extraordinary. And the other thing I remember is people in the audience, they have whiplash going back and forth, turning their heads between the two stages because they were oriented clearly towards the main stage, but then they'd get some action on the other stage and they'd turn back. It was pretty extraordinary, honestly, to be there, particularly after it came together following the little, you know, the little 45-minute hiccup.
I'm loving it. This is why we're here, and hopefully everybody that's out there listening can pick up a little bit of this and maybe, you know, take a little bit of this positivity and spread it out into the world, and that's what we're after, and just, you know, finding these little anecdotes, these little bits that brought us all together, and certainly, you know, really exciting to talk about some of these things that have now happened 30 plus years ago. And, you know, there are so many absolute, you know, undeniable tentacles to our scene that have allowed us to look forward to the next 5, 10, 20 years and know that this scene is going to continue to thrive. And I think, and that more core audiences are going to be built and that more joy is going to be brought to people through, you know, through all these artists. So, you know, I think that's what it's all about. And, you know, it's a constant evolution, something that's incredibly fluid and we're just riding down the river and trying to be good people to be on the river with.
That's fair. You know, we talked a lot about artists and experiences, but I can think of so many, you know, just people I went to shows with and still have that connection with. And that's just as deep and profound as anything relative to the music as well. You know, the friends that we have on both sides of the stage and where that's also led us and made us who we are to this day, I think is a big part of, you know, maybe not something we all together expound on in this context, but certainly, you know, are essential in defining who we are, who we've become. And again, where we're going. I'm psyched, man. I can't wait to hear this podcast, you know, what comes next, because I know all the people that you know, and I have a good sense of what's going down. So, yeah,
we've got some amazing people lined up for the first season, and you know, I'm just super grateful to Dean for joining us here today, and it felt really appropriate to have you on the first episode, because not only were you there at the, you know, inception of this scene, but you've really had your finger on the pulse and helped shape it over the last 30 years. And so I feel like that sets us up for a great journey, you know, over these next handful of episodes and really just finding that connective tissue between the jam scene, the mainstream, the core audiences, and of course the collaboration. And, you know, I just want to say thank you to Dean for being here, taking the time today and dropping all that incredible knowledge on us. And it's a pleasure. We certainly could do a whole season together. I hope to have Dean back later this season with another special guest, and look forward to seeing you all soon. I'm going to take a pause for a worthy cause, enjoy a bite of artisanal toast with some blackberry jam while I enjoy this 1974 Grateful Dead video from Winterland. And I just want to say thank you to the Osiris Network for hosting this podcast. And we're looking forward to seeing you down the road. Thanks for listening to The Jam. The Jam is hosted by Jonathan Shank, produced by RJB for Osiris Media, audio production by Matt Dwyer, recorded at Sony Music Studios in Culver City, music by Amar Sastry. Special thanks to Angel and Rob at Sony Studios, Emily Frost and Josh Winnick. Thanks for listening to The Jam, and see you next time.
Osiris.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen, and wherever you get your podcasts.